from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Christmas is around the corner, and the world sits on the cusp of war. My guest tonight, Sister Olga Yakob, is uniquely qualified to speak about both subjects. She's a nun from Iraq, that's right, and the first Assyrian Catholic nun in 700 years. This 4-foot-10-inch dynamo isn't afraid to speak her mind about hardship in her country after the Gulf War, what everyday Iraqis really think about Americans, about the looming threat of war. Two countries, hers and ours, stand at the intersection of war and peace. In this season of light and hope, Sister Olga joins us with a deep belief in love and mercy, and with stern warnings for a world enthralled with the force of arms. What are the demands of faith in a time of war? What part of the U.S.-Iraq conflict does belief like this address? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Sister Olga Yakob. Sister Olga, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you, Tom, for inviting me to be with you in this show. For me, it's a really great opportunity, and I believe this is by God's grace that he brought me here to give his message of peace and love and mercy, especially as you mentioned, we are preparing for a season of peace because it's birth of Prince of Peace.
Christmas is right on us. There's so much that we want to learn from you tonight, but I guess the place to begin is just with the fact that you're a nun from Iraq. We think of Iraq as a Muslim country, and certainly Saddam Hussein has emphasized the Islamic character of Iraq in the last decade. What's the background? Tell us your story. You grew up not in Baghdad, but a couple of hundred miles from there. What kind of family, and how did you come to be a nun?
A lot of people, it's the same question that you ask me when I meet them here. They were surprised. They are surprised that how could that be, like a religious sister from Iraq. But the reality that at the beginning, Iraq was 100% Christian country until the 4th century, when the Islamic religion started to move toward Gulf countries and including Iraq. Until 4th century, the whole country was Christian. We have still church from the 1st century, from 67, just 67 years.
The year 67.
Yes, from the 1st century. One of the disciples of our Lord, St. Thomas, he moved to Iraq, and he brought the Christianity to our people there. So until 4th century, all Iraqis were Christian.
I've heard you describe how Iraqis had to make a decision about Islam when it arrived. Could you share with us the formula that the Muslim wave, the choices that they offer to Iraqis?
Yeah, like they have three choices. First, you know, they talk with people if they want to believe, you know, in their religion, so they could change their faith, and they could pay tax. And you know, at that time, you know, all the people, they were farmers and poor people, so they didn't have, you know, this like enough money to pay. So most of them, because of, you know, fear or stress, or so they change, you know, like their faith and
became Muslim.
Became Muslim, yes. And you know, like as a Islam religions, they have each man could marry, you know, four women. So they grew up as a family, is more than, you know, Christian. And also because a lot stress on the Christians people there, most of people, they started, you know, to leave the country. So we became, you know, years and after years, you know, like a very small community. Now we are just 2% Christian there.
Christians make up 2% of Iraq's population.
Yes.
Historically, they could practice their religion if they paid a special tax, I think I've heard you say.
Yes, that was at the beginning, yes.
So your family was Christian when you were a girl in Iraq?
Yes, yes.
What did they ever expect that you would grow up and become a nun? Did you have such a religious family that was part of their expectation?
You know, they were as an ordinary Christian family. They go every Sunday to the church, but they didn't, you know, except one day that their daughter could be a nun. And actually, they were against this idea.
I know that your decision to become a nun and history are very much intertwined. Maybe it's the best way to understand it. When you were a girl, the mm-hmm. Iran-Iraq war was going on.
Yes.
When you were just becoming a young woman, I guess, mm-hmm. the Gulf War came. This is mm-hmm. when the United States and its coalition attacked Iraq after Iraq had invaded Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it would be helpful if you describe to us what the experience of being in Iraq during that Gulf War 10, 11 years ago was like for you and the people that you knew.
You know, actually, growing up in the situation of two wars, it's very difficult. Like, when I hear people here talking about war, I would have, you know, if I could tell them, you know, I wish if you could go back with me 20 years ago and live the experience of war. And after then, I don't believe that any of them could talk again about war. Because, as you mentioned, you know, like, first war, when they started, you know, Iran and Iraq, there were, you know, I was just 13 and 14 mm-hmm. years old. And 8 years I spent, you know, that time of my life just with bombing and, you know, all the message of hate and hurt each other and, you know, it was so difficult, you know, like for me to grow at that situation. And especially, you know, like when you listen to the, you know, TV news or all newspapers, mm-hmm. it's all, you know, like just people talking against each other. And, you know, like for me, just not just like growing as a Christian, but knowing God in very personal relationship, you know, like our God is God of love. So I cannot understand any other language against love. So when I heard all this hate and war and, you know, just people killing each other was very hard on my faith, you know, and I felt even like Jesus was crying in my little heart. It's not my human heart, but I wanted to stop that. But was the reality was, you know, bigger than my little heart to say something. Even I told even my family, they were against the idea that I could give my life to be just a messenger of love and mercy for people. And after then, we just, you know, they stopped war in 1988, and just 1990 and 1991, they start the Gulf War.
So the Iran-Iraq War ended in 1988, three
yes.
years later. Here mm-hmm. comes the invasion of Kuwait and then the Gulf War. What
yes.
was the experience of that war like for you as an Iraqi?
You know, to be honest with you, yes, we had, you know, war with Iraq for 8 years, and we hurt a lot, and that was a lot of damage, you know, mm-hmm. for our country. But for us, you know, having a Gulf War even for a few months, you know, I you know, I lived there, and I could tell you that those few months brought us back 200 years.
Why? Exactly why?
Because, you know, they were bombing not just every day, but sometime every single hour in 24 hours. And everywhere, we didn't know where we have to go. We didn't know how we could protect ourselves and family. They didn't know how to protect their children. You know, like, anywhere wasn't safe for us. They, you know, like, bombing was everywhere, like schools, hospitals, houses. You know, we didn't know, you know, like, everywhere.
You in Baghdad then or not?
No, I was born and grew up in Kirkuk. As you mentioned, mm-hmm. it's a little bit north than Baghdad. But because of, you know, Kirkuk is an oil city, so we moved from there just for a few months during the Gulf War. But at that time, I felt more that God is calling me to leave everything and to be his messenger of peace and forgiveness. Because when we moved from Kharkiv, we spent few months just in desert, you know.
Your family or other people as well?
Yeah, a lot of families from Kharkiv, because I told you it was oil city, so they all were afraid. If they, you know, bomb those oil places, it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, they will destroy
disaster.
The whole
city.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, almost
so
all the families.
Out of the town into the
yeah,
desert.
Yeah, we spent like almost 3 months there. Mm-hmm. Was very difficult, you know, like for me to see children dying for a cup of water. And, you know, parents asking why, where, you know, why that's happening for us, why America hates us, you know. I didn't find the question because I didn't know you. I didn't know anything about America.
Mm-hmm. What was your understanding as an ordinary Iraqi at that time? Did you understand that this was because the government of Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait?
Yeah, we understood that. Yes.
Did it seem justice to you that he would be pushed out because Kuwait is a sovereign nation, its own country, that other countries would come to its defense?
You know, I cannot understand war just by killing each other. You know, like, no matter what was the reason, if it was just or not, but it's just I don't agree with what happened. And still I don't agree with idea of war, not just with my country, but anywhere, because I lived this experience. You know, I saw people dying in front of me and I cannot do anything, and hundreds of people. And after Gulf War, that, you know, like, wasn't just those few months, you know, like, 12 years embargo. I told you I have been here a year and a half, you know, like...
In the United States.
Mm-hmm. So all those years of embargo, you know, like, there is nothing coming in the country for help. We didn't have anything to rebuild, you know, our country, to rebuild our hospitals, to take care of, you know, the sick people, the ill people. So, like...
Eventually, the government had money from oil sales that was supposed to be put toward food and medicine.
You know, to be honest, Tom, I could tell you my experience by living with those people and seeing their suffering. But maybe I'm not the right person to answer any political question, because all what I know about, you know, the government in Iraq, it's all what you know also from TV and news. I grew up in that country, but I never saw him.
Him being Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, I never saw him. I saw his pictures on newspapers or on TV, but I don't know anything about him.
So we'll take it from your ground level view then.
Mm-hmm.
What was the experience of the embargo for your family, for families around you?
You know, I told
this
you,
is
like,
the UN embargo, the sanctions, because Saddam's government never completely complied with, mm-hmm. with the UN obligations.
You know, the experience where I told you it was very hard, and still it's hard on my country, because, like, when there is nothing, almost nothing. When I hear people still talking about war, what we have left to have another war? There is nothing. You know, I studied two colleges there, just, you know, by light of oil lamp.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have electricity, you know, since years, you know, like, and you know that Iraq is it's hot country,
mm-hmm.
you know, very dry, warm country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have even fan. We don't have any kind of light, you know, like nothing. But so what we have left to have again war?
Your family eventually got out of Iraq.
Yes.
Went to Jordan, as I understand. You were along with them. They went on from there. You went back. How did you make that decision? Why?
Because, you know, like, I'm from that country. I saw all that suffer and pain. I saw Jesus crying in tears of those people. I saw Jesus calling me to do something, you know, to visit him and those prisoners that for nothing, just for stealing, because they are hungry. You know, they spent, you know, all those years in the jail. And many children, you know, were born handicapped because of all those chemical bombing they used them in the Gulf War and uranium and all those stuff. You know, like, I wasn't able, you know, like, just to ignore face of Jesus and those children and those elderly people and those prisoners. You know, I want to just, you know, I wish if I have more than this life to give them. So for this reason, when I told to my parents, I have to be a religious because I want to give the rest of my life to God, to serve those people, wasn't easy for them to understand because they also grew up in suffering. They told me, what do you think yourself? You cannot save the world. You cannot mm-hmm. save your country.
Mm-hmm.
So they promised me when we leave Iraq, they will let me be a sister in Jordan. But I felt they were just want to take me away from there. So I left because I felt God wants me to do something.
And went back into Iraq and into the prisons in Iraq.
Yes.
Is that politically possible? Our impression is that if you went into the prisons of Iraq, you might end up a prisoner yourself.
No, it wasn't easy, especially women. You know, and I went back first as a laywoman, you know, almost 4 years until 1995 I entered religious life. So for 4 years I was, you know, serving as a laywoman. Wasn't easy at all, but as I told you, from the beginning, wasn't my decision, but God still is calling me to do his work, to give his mission, to give his message. So all what I have done until now, it's because I trust his power. It's his work, it's not me.
We're talking tonight with Sister Olga Yaakob, an Iraqi nun, on the inner life of her country, and in a moment of ours, you can join the conversation. What are the demands of faith in a time of war, and what is it about the Iraqi people that you want to hear from this sympathetic soul? We are tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Sister Olga Yaqob, an Iraqi nun, on the inner life of her country and perhaps of ours. Can you imagine the strength of spirit it takes to walk from freedom back into Iraq to tend to the suffering? And I guess I wonder what portion of the U.S.-Iraq conflict does belief like this address at this point? Could love be the answer, or are we beyond that now? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sister Olga, we want to understand more about your personal journey, but give us a few observations, if you would, first, about the things that Americans don't understand about Iraq, the things that Iraqis don't understand about America.
You know, because of situation of war and especially because of situation of embargo, there is no any communication between those two countries, between Americans and Iraqi people. So before I came here, I didn't know anything. I didn't know even any American person, you know. And I guess same thing, you know, for Americans people. They don't hear anything from us because in Iraq there is, you know, until I left, it wasn't any kind of communication, like through internet or computer or cell phone and all those stuff. We don't have them in Iraq.
But we have begun to hear a lot about the suffering of Iraqi people under Saddam Hussein. Stories of, you know, whole families wiped out, of people imprisoned and tortured. I mean, we do hear that.
You know, to tell you the truth, yes, our life in Iraq, it's not easy. You know, it's so painful. It's so so hard life. It's not easy at all from many perspective, you know. And especially, to be honest with you, even as a religions, you know, it's not easy for human being, and it's not easy even for living, you know, your religions there. Because what happened since Gulf War, like people, as an Islam people in Middle East, and especially in Iraq, I could tell you, they understood that it's war, religions war. It's not
politics. A religious war.
So they start, like, hate us as a Christian, even though we are Iraqis.
But Iraq was not historically such a... It was more secular than many Middle Eastern countries.
Yes, but, you know, I told you that because before I came here, as an Iraqis people, we think about America as Christian country, like 100% they are Christian. So when they were bombing Iraq, you know, why? The question was, why Christian hate us? I mean, you know, from Islam people in Iraq, why they hate us, you know? So they start, you know, doing even, you know, different kind of pressure on Christian in Iraq.
Making it more difficult to practice Christianity?
Yes, like we didn't have that before Gulf War. But, you know, after that, I told you, because for them, they think that it's a religion war. It's not just politics, you know.
You told a story about how even the giving of Christian names to new babies became difficult and discouraged.
Yeah, it's really very difficult, you know, like because, you know, they think all the Christian name is American name. So why we are using those American name? You know, like it's not easy for them to understand, like those Christian name is biblical name. So they could be used in America and France and Iraq and everywhere for Christian community, you know. But for them, they think like all this Christian name, it's, you know, American name. So we shouldn't use them anymore.
So you're saying, first of all, many Iraqis understood it as a religious war, and the government no doubt encouraged that, I suppose. What else do Iraqis not know or understand of importance about the United States or life outside Iraq today?
You know, to be honest, because, like, they have been suffering, you know, because of embargo all those years, and they believe that the decision is from United States by keeping this embargo on Iraq. So they have this fear, like, what's this power, you know? We have this fear from America. We have this fear why they hate us. We have this fear what they are going to do more for us, you know? Like, to be honest, you know, I'm part of that country, part of those people. Before I came, I have same question like all of them. So when I came here, I was, like, really shocked.
Why?
You know? Because people here, there is a lot good people. I cannot express how wonderful people you have here in your country. And I feel sorry, you know, from idea of war, because it's brought, it's brought a lot of misunderstanding between those two nations, you know. Like, people here, they have fear from Iraq, and people in Iraq, they have fear from America. Mm-hmm. And the reality in those two countries, there is a lot of good people, but there is no dialogue. There is no any communication. And the problem also, like, I heard so much from this idea, because they look at each other from religion's perspective, and this is not true. It's not religion's war. It's just politic issue, you know. Yeah. It's not with people. There is innocent people on both sides. And I told you, as an Iraqi woman, you know, living here in the United States, I could see how wonderful people there is here, you know. Like, I get a lot of help from American people, you know, everywhere where I'm studying, you know, here at Boston University, or as a Catholic church here in Boston, or religious community sisters where I live with them. They're all American, but I told them in my letters, I wrote letter for few of them when they start the idea, you know, beginning of November, like idea of having again Iraq, you know, war with Iraq. Mm. I said, yes, in Iraq, I saw face of Jesus and I heard voice of Jesus in the people of my country calling me to give my life for them. But here in America, with those wonderful American people that I have met here, I saw hands of Jesus, you know, giving me all the graces and blessings that I have receiving from those American people that I have met them here.
But right now, it would appear that Iraq and the United States are on a collision course toward war.
Yeah.
Is there another way? Americans look at Iraq and are told to see a threat. They see a people apparently suffering under a very difficult government. It doesn't look like a situation where just sitting back is really a solution, mm-hmm. as you or is it?
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I could give you a short answer, and this is message of, you know, Holy Father Pope John Paul II, when he said, you know, if you want peace, you know, we need to have justice, but there is no justice without forgiveness. You know, the problem between America and United States, no of them want to forgive.
And Iraq, you mean? Neither side.
Yeah, mm-hmm. United States and Iraq, you know, we need to forgive each other. And then we could talk about justice and we could get the peace of God. But we have to forgive each other.
Is that possible with the current government in Iraq?
It is possible if all of us work together. It's not possible when I said, you know, it's not my business, it's your business. And you could say, it's not my business, it's, you know, others' people's business. It's not possible in that way. But if we all work together, yes, it is possible. And maybe people could think because I am a nun, but before I became a nun, I am a human being. And I am, as a Christian, I could say, like, we cannot do that if we don't return to God in a very close relationship. We have to pray. We need life of prayer. We need to listen to God, because He is God of forgiveness. He is God of love and justice and peace. And I could tell you this image of God, God of forgiveness and peace and mercy, it's not just from Christian perspective. I read a lot from Quran, and I studied Islam religions, I studied Judaism. Mm-hmm. In all those three religions, they have same perspective about God, that God is God of forgiveness and peace. So we have all together to return to God, to find the dialogue of love, because God is love. We cannot do that by ourselves.
Sister Olga, stand by. A lot of people want to join our conversation. I want to invite them in. Tom's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I have many, many friends, as Sister was saying, and in Madison here in Europe, my wife's European, that are really, really appalled at what's about to happen. I mean, you know, on the news they say if, well, you know, most of us, that's, I don't even know why they use it, but the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, the frustrating thing, I mean, there's this perception of the United States as we have access to what's going on, and, you know, the media here is, you know, I don't know what it's like in Iraq, and I don't really know, like, what it's like anywhere, because I don't live there, but here it's very difficult. My wife brings back news from Europe, and other than public radio and some sites on the Internet, we don't have any more power than a lot of people do around the world knowing what's going on, what the government's really doing. And
Tom, when you hear Sister Olga say the real solution here is a dialogue of love, does that sound like a real solution to you, or does that sound like a religious ideal that's distant to you?
Well, to me it sounds like a solution that's never been approached. I mean, I am not, you know, I'm a spiritual, not religious person. I went to dinner last night with a friend who fought the Russians. He's Afghan. He's a Muslim, and he's probably as much like Jesus as anybody I know around this city. And the sad thing is, from the outset, my country has never, I've never heard anyone anywhere say, let's open a dialogue and find out why this happened, and let's work together. From the get-go, it's been, let's go get them. And I feel very sad for the Iraqi people and the people here, because no one's approached it that way. They haven't even tried.
Tom, thank you for your call. Sister Olga, you hear the longing for a different way in this caller's comments.
Yeah, I totally agree with him. You know, the problem that, you know, nobody think about that. You know, nobody even, you know, try to open the door of dialogue. And I told you, the main reason, because I'm sorry to say that, you know, like, people, they are very far away from God. So they have they don't have anymore this human heart to open it for love. We have a lot stony heart. I'm sorry to say that, but this is the reality. You know, when I take train, I see all those people. You know, sometimes I love just to smile in face of people, just to say good morning or I wish you a wonderful day, you know. But I see all those people, like, almost, if there is like 50 people in the train, 20 of them, they have headphones listening to what they want to sing.
Music on the headphones.
And like 10 people talking in cell phone, and another 20 just reading papers or book. So there is no any contact. I love to see eyes of people. I love to see even smile of faces. But there is no contact.
Anne's calling from Madison. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I agree with your guest and with the previous caller completely. And it seems to me that it's the cruelty and greed and indifference of national leaders that's causing the war against Iraq, the horrible coming second war against Iraq, which we've basically already destroyed. But I wanted to hear something more specific about the conditions you found in the prisons in Iraq, if you could.
Yes, I'd like to as well, Anne. Thanks for your call. Sister Olga, you mentioned two things that you were working with in Iraqi prisons and with Iraqi children who were born with birth defects.
Yes.
First, the prisons.
Yeah.
How did you gain access? How were you received as a Christian nun, and what were the conditions there?
You know, first, we started our mission. I told you I was just as a laywoman, and by God's grace, you know, he gave me this gift of giving his message to his people. So I started working in different parishes with young adult people. And after then, I asked them if they could join with me as a young adult group, you know, just serving poor people in our country. We didn't, you know, decide that we're going to start from prisons. So we called our group Love Your Neighbor. And through the parishes, we started to collect, like, food and clothes and some, you know, medicines or money, whatever they have, you know, to give it to the poor people. And after then, I hear it, like, we have a prison for almost children, you know, between 8 to 14 years old. And the reason that just because they needed food, they needed, you know, something to eat. So they just stole, you know, for reason of stealing, you know, they are spending years in the jail. So I decided to visit those children first, because, like, I didn't imagine, like, children in the prison, you know. So when I started visiting them and I asked permission, just, you know, I don't want to do anything. I just want to bring food for them. And because of situation of embargo, they opened the door for me just to bring food. But they asked me, because, you know, as a Christian, they asked me, are you going to bring food just for Christian? I told them, no, I'm going to give the same piece of bread for Christian and Islam, because they all people of God, you know, and from love of God, I want to just give to everybody. So we started serving first the children in the prisons. And after then, I hear that there is a prison for women. And, you know, like, I didn't imagine that, too. You know, it was too much for me. But because of God's grace, you know, he gave me his strength. So I went to the women's prison, and I started serving there too. And from same, you know, perspective, just bringing food at the beginning, this was the mission. And after then, we moved to the men's prison. The same reason was just helping with food and with clothes, and especially like we had a. Like some women were pregnant and they give birth to their babies in the jail.
And what were the conditions that you found in the prisons? What were the circumstances?
First, it's very difficult. It's different than the prisons that you have here. You know, I visited some prisons in Chicago. It's completely different. You know, like they don't have enough food. They don't have good water. Sometimes they don't take bath even, you know, once a month or, you know, sometime 2 months. Mm-hmm. It's not healthy at all, and there is no education, nothing. It's just like a big, huge building, just, you know, punish those people and bring them there. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, you know, like, and this is what made me sad, you know, like in my daily prayer, I was asking, you know, God, just give me your answer, what you want me to do. Because, like, you could imagine people, you know, children growing in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to be for the next generation? Mm-hmm. You know, or women who they were pregnant and give birth to their babies, and they are growing also in the prison.
And the disabled children that you saw who were born with birth defects after, I guess, the Iran-Iraq War and perhaps the Gulf War as well?
Yeah,
are they gathered together in hospitals, in special homes? Are they spread throughout the community and families?
No, like most of them, they are in a special building, and it depends on ages. Like we put them, like who they are, very little, you know, babies until like 8 years old in different building. And when
are you sure that their birth defects are related to the war and chemicals arms used there?
Yes, yeah, because before Gulf War, we didn't have this kind of it's very, very strange, you know.
Like what?
Like. Without two hands, without two arms, it's very strange. And sometimes you could see body of human being, but face, it's not human face. It's very strange. Like we never had those kind of birth before.
And does the government support these children?
You know, they are, like the houses that we visit them, they all public houses. Mm-hmm. It's belong to the government, but there is no any help, no at all. You know, like. They depend of, you know, on donations, you know, like, and the people who could, you know, like, take care of them and bring those donations for them.
So that's a pretty tough life.
It is. It is.
How much of the Iraqi prison population of these children were you able to touch, to serve a tiny percentage of them? I mean, we hear stories of lots and lots of people in prison in Iraq.
Yeah, like, actually... I was working in Baghdad, the capital city, so I visited, you know, all the prisons that we have in Baghdad as a capital city. We have for men and women, for teenager and for children. And they are a lot, yes.
We are talking tonight with Sister Olga Yaqob, an Iraqi nun, on the inner life of her country and perhaps of ours. Can you hear how much each country does not know about the other? Does it take a tiny nun to show the way to ultimate resolution, maybe to peace? Is belief like this a distraction, or is it key? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with an Iraqi nun, Sister Olga, on the inner life of her country, Iraq, and ours, the United States. What are the demands of faith in a time of war? Can you imagine the strength of spirit it takes to walk from freedom back into Iraq to tend to the suffering? And what portion of the U.S.-Iraq conflict does belief like this address? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Phil's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great program. The concern with the issue of dialogue, which was raised in the previous two calls, mm-hmm. is troubling. The American people, given the opportunity, would inevitably welcome a dialogue with the Iraqi people, mm-hmm. and I assume the reverse is true. The problem with dialogue isn't with the people, and in fact, the American people, and for that matter, the American military establishment, doesn't seek to punish anybody in Iraq other than one person and his inner circle of people who have found great satisfaction for the last however many years he's been in power. I think it's 35 or so, and certainly in the last 10, of subjugating the rights of men and women and children systematically and brutally. The American people, as a you know, really a group of immigrants, has created a sense of sensitivity and consciousness in everything we do. If you look at the Eighth Amendment protections against search and seizure, cruel and unusual punishment, Miranda, our whole criminal procedure is geared towards protecting the rights of people. The Al-Qaeda terrorists and suspected terrorists who are in American prisons and under the watch of the Navy down in Cuba have far better living conditions than virtually any Iraqi prisoners, so far as we know today. So the issue of dialogue is totally agreeable, and I think that there's very little objection to that. But to say that the American people are missing the point misses the point.
Phil, let me put that straight to Sister Olga.
You know, I totally agree with you, and I trust that, especially after I came here, and the kindness of people here made me really to trust how much people here, they have a great love and passion to the people in Iraq. I saw many times American people, you know, like holding signs of peace during the month of November and December, and no war for Iraq, you know, like I totally agree, you know, with you at this point. But at the same time, the dialogue isn't going to be just when we open the two doors and travel from here to there and from there to here. But I said, you know, it's responsibility of each of us to start from your own place, from your own way, through your own way. Like each of us, we could do that. Like maybe for many people, like even some sisters, they were asking me, you know, are you crazy? You're going to talk about peace and almost it's going to be war with Iraq. I'm not crazy to talk about peace, but just I have hope, not just my hope. It's not from my love to American people or to Iraqi people, but my hope is because of God. I know that God has a great love to his people, no matter where they are, here or in Iraq. And second, I have trust of love of people here who they are helping a little none, that I'm maybe one person here that all those people around me, you know, like how much helping me.
But Sister Olga, Phil says American people are ready for a dialogue with Iraq, ready to help Iraq, but in his words, one man stands in the way.
Yeah, but I want to ask this question, you know, how we could let, you know, like all those people paying the price because of one man. You know, we have to think about those people too. You know, we shouldn't stop the dialogue because there is one man. You know, there is how many millions there? We have to think about those millions, not just to think about one person.
Phil, thank you for your call. Michael's calling. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. How you doing, Tom? Thanks
well,
for taking
thanks.
My call.
Sure.
I'd just like to remind your guest that the German people had to pay a price for the actions of Hitler. And it's too bad that they did have to pay a price, but, you know, that's just the way of the world. Also, I'd like to ask, if she was alive during World War II, would she have protested that war? And if she did protest it, how would she have solved the problems of that era without going to war?
It's a tough question, but let me, I see Sister Olga, Michael is saying, you know, in this country, in the political conversation in this country, Saddam Hussein has been compared to Hitler. You may accept that, you may not accept it, but it's widely taken on board here that there's some, you know, very rough parallel. Michael's saying, in World War II, with your attitude, would you have stood back and not opposed Hitler, I guess is the heart of the question.
Like, stand back about...
Well, I guess, Saddam Hussein is seen as a great evil, in the words of our president. And when such a great evil presents itself, what is the correct path? To go to a dialogue of love or to go to a dialogue of arms, of force, to remove that person who that in the view of some people, stands in the way of a more loving relationship.
A dialogue of love, not of arms.
Even then? Mm-hmm. Even if the enemy is as evil as Adolf Hitler?
Yes. It's my perspective. It's my perspective.
Michael, you're talking to a nun here.
Yeah, I just like to...
You know, Michael, it's not because I am nun, honestly, but, you know, I told you I was that there in that war, you know, like...
Yeah, but we're living in the real world here. We have to take care of people that are very violent. You know, how if we took the police off the streets in the city of Boston, mm-hmm. you know, and say, well, yeah, everyone has, you know, look to God and we'll try love, people will be robbing each other blind.
But, know? Michael, what about, speaking of the real world, what about, what do you think when Sister Olga describes the suffering of Iraqis?
I'd like to say, how about the suffering of the Kurdish people when they were gassed?
You know, are we going to let this
guy keep on gassing his own people? No. We have to step in and we have to get rid of this guy.
Sister Olga.
I am part of North, you know. I am part of those Kurdish people. I was born there and I grew up there. I know they're suffering too, you know, but it's at the same time, you know, it's just, you know, believe me, it's very painful having experience of war. You know, it's not just, I cannot explain it by words, you know, for this reason, you know, I cannot imagine having war again. And maybe I said at the beginning, I don't like idea of war, not just in Iraq, but anywhere, for I don't like idea of war for human being.
Mm. Michael, thanks for your call. Mark's calling from Oshkosh. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Evening.
My thought is this. The Bush administration loves to cloak itself in the mantle of Christianity. And the conservative Christian right loves to play lapdog to the Bush administration. But I think your guest tonight exposes them for the hypocrites that they are. The Jesus that I know in the Bible never raised his voice to anybody but the hypocrites who love to cloak themselves in religious trappings and weigh their people down with burdens that they themselves would not bear. The only people that Jesus ever raised his hand to were the money changers in the temple. And if you look carefully at this thing, this whole thing is a war about black gold. It has nothing to do with anything other than money.
Mark, our time is running down, but I appreciate your call and thank you for it. Sister Olga, your final thoughts. We only have half a minute more. Are you still hopeful in prayer for peace? Even now?
Yes. Yeah. I'm still hoping of, you know, having peace with Iraq. And I trust that, you know, I trust that the faith that God has given me by his grace. It's not I have very strong faith, but my faith is gift and grace from God. So I trust from Prince of Peace that he's going to bring peace between those two nations. No matter what is the reason, what's going on, but because of his love to his people and his mercy, he's going to open those stony heart and give them heart of love.
Sister Olga Yaakob, we salute your faith, and I thank you for coming in tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
Much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, an American reflects on the relationships he forged in Saudi Arabia. This is On Point. First, the Bush administration hired Madison Avenue ad executive Charlotte Beers to buff up America's image overseas. Then, last week, the New York Times reported that the Pentagon is debating plans to covertly plant pro-American news stories in foreign countries. 25-year-old Orlando resident Patrick Hanna thinks he knows a better way to influence the Arab world view of Americans. Hanna has spent much of the past year in the Saudi Arabian city of Jubail. His job was to assess the damage caused by Saddam Hussein's intentional dumping of 11 million barrels of oil into the Persian Gulf while Iraq was at war with the United States in 1991. In this radio diary, Hanna says that simple human interaction is the only way to break down the barriers of understanding between Americans and Arabs.
Does the State Department pay for freelance diplomacy? This thought bounced into my head as I munched on freshly slaughtered lamb a few weeks ago on a small, nearly deserted island off the Persian Gulf coast of Saudi Arabia. It's now 10 years after the Persian Gulf War oil spill, the largest oil spill in history, and the company I work for was in the middle of the largest oiled shoreline survey project in history, a project funded by the Saudi government to map the effects of the spill and hopefully force the Iraqi government to pay for the work of cleaning it up. We were on the island to search for spilled oil, and our presence there so pleased its owner, also the local sheikh, that he invited us for a feast. As our hosts watched us eat and photograph each other posing in their elaborate tents, I myself watched our hosts and couldn't help but wonder, how would their impressions of us color their impressions of Americans in general, of the United States? And was it truly fair for me to suspect that these people, having so graciously held a feast in our honor, might harbor any ill will toward us, simply because we are Americans and they are Saudis? Questions similar to those that lingered in my mind during our afternoon with the Sheikh may be common among Americans living in the Middle East at this time of heightened social and political tensions. And the context of our involvement in the oil shoreline survey seemed riddled with ironies that cast an even more curious light on my perceptions of the place and its people. We are Americans hired to look for oil waste, the leftovers of the stuff that maintains the status quo and drives the power politics of the region, just when our own government is preparing for a war against the very dictator who spilled it there in the first place. Every day we are surrounded by the waste of old wars. Indeed, the oil caked on the Gulf beaches reads almost like a short archaeological history of conflict in the region. Persian Gulf War oil is brown and gray, but sometimes beside it lies black, hardened, weathered oil spilled during the Iran-Iraq War in 1983. And whether or not Hussein or our own leaders care to recognize it, oil itself is a weapon of mass destruction, at least from the perspective of burrowing crabs and saltwater plants. 10 years after the war, mile after square mile of Gulf marshes lie dead, choked of life. Life for a Westerner working in Saudi Arabia seems to me strangely subdued. My assumptions about the tensions lurking around us have been tested and reworked time and again. My experiences there have been mixed, as have those of others in my group. Any of us who were runners have given up that hobby for the time being. As Westerners, to go out for a jog is to invite yells and strange looks from passersby. I asked a Saudi friend of mine why this was, and he quickly explained, "Oh, they're encouraging you." It seemed to me much more like harassment. And there was a night in town when a street child glared at us and aggressively mimicked with his hands what looked like the flight of an airplane into a building. It shook us all up, and it made us wonder, who would teach a child something like that? But people there have shown that they are just as curious about us as we are about them. The afternoon that my friends and I spent in the park playing frisbee prompted more than one passing Saudi to stop and watch. But when one of our group took out some of his rock climbing gear, set it up between two trees, and began practicing on it, we soon had a crowd of 10 cars packed with people idling and watching intently. His dismount brought whistles and applause. And our friend the Sheikh was not the first one to invite us for a feast of slaughtered lamb in the desert, nor do I think he will be the last. These and other experiences have been positive, and have taught me that many Saudis are thoughtful, gracious, and often warm. But I also learned that to let one's guard down for too long in public is to risk being shocked, maybe simply with a sharp reminder that some of the liberties that we take for granted are glaringly absent here. When we headed back to the States for the holidays, our friend the Sheikh left us with an open invitation to visit him again. I hope that we can take him up on it.
Patrick Hanna lives in Orlando, Florida. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.